in, everyone, and welcome to it, the Daily Daily Caller Podcast for another Monday. Those Mondays just keep on rolling on. I'm Derek Hunter. It's July 1st, 2019. The first half of the year is officially done. Oh, yes, we can put it in the books. As you may or may not know, if you're new to the show, welcome to the show. You can email me, derek@dailycaller.com. Compliments, complaints, whatever you want. I encourage you, I ask you, I implore you to share this show with your friends, with your family, with your enemies, with strangers. Because what better way to break the ice than to walk up to somebody out of the blue and say, you should subscribe to a podcast by a guy you've never heard of. I think, you know, marriages will come out of that. And I don't know if there's a better pickup line in the world. This week is a different kind of week. It's the first week. If massive news breaks, I'll be here with a brand new show, or at least part of a brand new show. But in general, this week, as summer is in full swing and we celebrate the anniversary of this nation's birth, this glorious nation's Declaration of Independence, on Thursday, I am taking my foot off the gas and doing family things this week. But like I said, if something massive breaks, I'll be here with at least some stuff. So as such, what you don't know about the show, if you're new to it, and you picked the wrong week to sign up, but welcome anyway, is that on Fridays, we do interviews. We do video interviews on thedailycaller.com, and we take a transcript would make a very boring podcast. Here's a bunch of printed words. We take the audio of that interview and put it in this program. And we have been lucky, and by we, I mean me, have been incredibly lucky to have some really interesting people come through our doors to talk with me and thereby talk to you. So I thought we should revisit those because, you know, you sit down with somebody and they're very fascinating and then you go, well, that's out on a Friday and then you've got to just kind of move on and forget it. Well, thank God for the internet because you can capture all these things forever. The internet is forever. Usually that's used in a menacing way to refer to nude selfies and stupid things that people have tweeted, but it also comes in handy when you've talked to really interesting people and you think, man, there are a lot more people listening to the show now than when we interviewed so-and-so. If only they could go back 6 months and hear it. Well, you can't do all of them because there's a new interview every week, but we can do some of them. And as such, that's what we're going to do. Since the Russia garbage is still alive, and you wouldn't think it would be after the Mueller report release, I thought we should start off this week by revisiting one of my favorite guests, Fox News legal analyst Greg Jarrett. He had a massive best-selling book called The Russia Hoax, not The Russian Hoax. If you watch TV, you'd think that's what it was called, but it's not that hard to read. There's no N at the end. The Russia Hoax. And he came into our studios, and we had a very cool, very in-depth, interesting discussion. The guy knows his stuff, and he's very compelling, and he was super nice off camera as well. Actually, I don't think that we've interviewed anybody who was a jackass off camera. There were a couple of people I was surprised at how cool and relaxed and fun they were. We'll have one of those later on in the week as well, and I'll tell you who that is when that comes up. But I thought, Greg Jarrett, what he's talking about is still relevant because the Democrats are still trying to pretend that what is, isn't, and what isn't, is. They've called up Robert Mueller to the Hill to testify on July 17th. They're still beating this poor dead horse. They should just bury it or make it into glue or something. But there's no political gain for that. They're pot committed to this idea. So I thought, why not replay the interview we did with probably the world's foremost expert on the law and the hoax that is the Russia investigation. So here it is. Without any further ado, I thank you for listening. I'll be back tomorrow with another long rambling intro to an interview. But here it is without any further ado. Really, this time, no further ado is Greg Jarrett on the Daily Daily Caller podcast from about 6 months ago. Actually, it was August 10th, 2018. So I'm done with the ado. No further ado, here is the Greg Jarrett interview.
Already, hello again, everyone, and welcome to the Daily Daily Caller Podcast. I am Derek Hunter. I am your host, and as we do on the video version on Fridays, we suck somebody out of their real life and drag them into our miserable worlds. And today, we're lucky enough to be joined by Greg Jarrett, legal analyst for Fox News and author of The Russia Hoax, New York Times bestseller, The Illicit Scheme to Clear Hillary Clinton and Frame Donald Trump. Welcome to the show, Greg.
Great to be here, Derek.
I got to ask you, before we get into the meat of the book, how did it come about? How did you find yourself writing about this Russia hoax? You know, you were a legal analyst, you were a reporter, you're a journalist, you were
a lawyer,
a trial lawyer.
Yes.
I have a problem with, but we'll look past that for today. But how did you find yourself going from that to author and sort of the leading voice on the Russia investigation?
I was writing a lot of columns, a couple of hundred of them over the last 3 years, and initially I began writing about how Hillary Clinton had done all of her business as Secretary of State on, you know, an unauthorized, unsecured server in the basement of her home.
I've done the same thing.
We all should. So I wrote a bunch of those columns saying this is a crime. There are 110 crimes here for 110 classified documents. And she was lying all along, offering one excuse after another. And actually, in the book, I go through all of those lies. And then when James Comey stood in front of cameras and cleared her doing this tremendous legal somersault, I knew he was lying, or he is the worst lawyer in America.
The no reasonable prosecutor.
Right.
After laying on a damning case, it's like, it would be like Chris Darden and Marsha Clark sitting up there.
Right.
Here's where we found the glove. There's blood everywhere. There's OJ's blood. But no reasonable prosecutor would believe that anything was other than a shaving accident. That's kind of what he did.
That's a great comparison, especially since I covered the OJ case for 9 months back in the 90s. Very much like that. And it wasn't his job to make that decision. And that is a legal standard that he just invented. And by the way, I have yet to find a prosecutor, reasonable or otherwise, who wouldn't have loved to have brought that case. There was so much evidence of criminality. So I wrote about that. When the Trump-Russia investigation began, first with the FBI, then Bob Mueller, I wrote even more columns. And it really culminated in a column I wrote calling it a hoax. And in the book, you know, I lay out the law, the facts, the evidence. I reach some inexorable conclusions, but I think the readers will as well. But that was really, it was the thesis of a column that I then turned into a book.
Let's talk about the investigation itself. We sort of know how it began, or at least we keep on hearing new stories and new versions of it.
Right.
Started earlier, and oh, it started with Papadopoulos drunkenly bragging in London about how the
right.
Russians are going to give him all this information. But then we find out that there's investigative documents or related documents that predate that, which if the FBI has the ability to see into the future, send me some lottery numbers, please. Where did this investigation come from? Let me just add one more thing, because I just remember in the book Shattered about Hillary Clinton's devastating loss in 2000. I still brings a smile on my face. Loss in 2016. There's a story in there about how the day after in Brooklyn, the campaign brain trust kind of gets together to try and figure out what they can blame for their loss, because this was
sure.
a tap and putt,
right.
and they screwed it up. And they seem to agree, according to the reporting in that book, that they would go with blaming Russia
right.
as a major part of it. I hadn't heard much about this aside from the hacking, blaming Russia, but somehow that, from that, in my mind, seems to be where the narrative sort of started, of blaming Russia for their failures. But where did the actual investigation start?
Well, that actually makes sense, because as I explain in the book, Papadopoulos Bartok is not the basis for a counterintelligence investigation.
Right. Let's spy on an American because some guy was trying to get laid.
Right. You hear a rumor that's been passed along now as quadruple hearsay. You happen to mention it to an Australian diplomat who waits 2 months and notifies the FBI over what? We all hear rumors. That doesn't make it evidence of a crime
right.
or plausible intelligence for a counterintelligence probe. The New York Times actually ran with that story, and they were duped. It was the FBI that fed them that story to try to cover up the real reason, which was the dossier. Christopher Steele, in fact, as recently as a few days ago, we learned that Christopher Steele, the author of the anti-Trump dossier, which is phony on its face, he was on the payroll of the FBI beginning 7 months before the FBI launched its investigation. So here's a guy, Steele, he's on the payroll of Hillary Clinton and Democrats.
But
and
they,
he's on
they
the
did
payroll
a good job of masking that. It
oh,
went
sure.
through a law, Perkins Coie.
Right.
Then it went to Fusion GPS. There were 6 degrees of separation. They made sure to keep their fingers.
A little bit like money laundering,
right.
as we say in the legal biz. So here's a guy. He's being paid by the FBI, 11 payments. They know he's a liar and not to be trusted because the first month he's hired in January of 2016, he's admonished by the FBI for his behavior. We don't know why, because the FBI redacts that information. They love redactions.
Yes, they do.
We don't know the amounts of the payments. They redact that, too. There's no justification for redacting it. So, you know, here he is. He is composing this completely fabricated dossier that is, I mean, I've read it 100 times. You know, viewers should read it. I never fail to laugh.
Don't let children read it.
It is the work of an amateur dime novelist in junior high school who's trying to impress his good-looking teacher. It's just silliness, all of it. You know, for example, it claims that Putin and Trump had been conspiring to throw the election anywhere from 5 to 8 years previously. I mean, come on. And the FBI knew that this was a phony document. They didn't care. They wanted to use it as a pretext to launch an investigation that would damage Trump and destroy his presidency if he won.
But they did, and they used that document in many ways. And by, you know, they used it as itself, and then they used Michael Isikoff. Christopher Steele talking to Michael Isikoff about the document. So point two in the application for the FISA warrant is a story written based on the document leaked by the author. Tell us a little bit about that, because they used it 3 times, didn't they? And they didn't necessarily clarify that it was each thing stemmed from this one little acorn.
Right.
They said they were 3 separate instances.
It's what's called circular sourcing. They basically lied to the FISA court judges. They represented in their documents, the application to wiretap, that they had an independent corroborating source, which was a newspaper report.
Based on the document.
Based on the document. And not only that, I mean, the worst part of it is they concealed vital evidence and they deceived the judges. For example, they don't explain that Hillary Clinton is really, you know, the source of this through funding. Adam Schiff, who's the minority member of the intelligence, it's in a footnote. Well, I put the footnote in the book, footnote number 8. And when my wife first read the book, she turned to me. We were on an airplane. She said, "Are you kidding me? Like, who in their right mind could figure out from that footnote the source of the funding of the dossier? It was cleverly hidden."
Harry Reid played a role in this with James Comey, did he not? In the launching of this? Tell us about him.
Because
he's corrupt as the day is
long. Oh, he is. Harry Reid is the king of smears. We remember it from the Mitt Romney presidential campaign in which he stood on the floor of the U.S. Senate and claimed Romney hadn't paid taxes in 10 years.
He did it on the floor of the Senate because he had absolute immunity from any libel issues that if he'd have said it outside of his office, he would have been sued into nothing for.
And it was a lie by Harry Reid.
Yes.
And
which he proudly admitted.
Yeah, when he went out of the Senate and he was interviewed after, he sort of bragged about it in the interview that he damaged Romney. So what happens is the CIA director in 2016, which is John Brennan, who is a Hillary Clinton sycophant and lackey of the Clintons, supposed to be nonpartisan, he was anything but. He learns of the dossier, and he, more than anybody else, was propagating the dossier. He was running with this thing in his hand to anybody who would listen, and he goes to Harry Reid on Capitol Hill.
Did he believe it, do you think? He just know that it could be damaging because you couldn't disprove what was in it?
Exactly. Even Christopher Steele said in court documents, it is unverifiable. It's impossible to verify.
Never let the facts stand in the way of a good story.
Because it's based on anonymous sources and triple and quadruple hearsay. I mean, it's just garbage. But Brennan doesn't care because he's going to use this to help Hillary clear the path to the White House because he wants to keep his job as CIA director. In Washington, it's all about perpetuating your own power. So it goes to Reid, and, you know, it appears that he divulged the information of the dossier. Reid sends a letter to Comey, collusion between Trump and the Russians, and immediately leaks it to the media. And with that word, collusion, they're off to the races.
So those were the three uses of the Steele dossier. In all of your research for the Russia hoax, there are a lot of people, who you've just named some of them, that have obviously self-interest involved or partisan hackery involved. Is there anybody you think was actually duped, where they just didn't know any better, sort of, like, I don't know. I just use James Comey as an example, but I don't believe this about James Comey. But James Comey really thought, wow, there could be something here. We should look into this.
Now,
is there anybody in this food chain that is...
Nobody in this food chain. All of these people were active participants in initiating and perpetuating the hoax. And when I say hoax, I'm not referring to Russian meddling in the election, because I explain in detail that appears to have happened. I'm talking about Trump-Russia conspiracy to influence the election, to win the election. James Comey, the most amazing thing about Comey is he sits down on May 2nd, 2016, 2 months before Hillary Clinton and 16 other key witnesses are even interviewed. And he knows she is a criminal. He knows she broke the law. So he writes down a statement of her illegality, and he uses the term gross negligence right out of the criminal statute, not once, but twice. He then shows it to his staff, but says, I want to exonerate her anyway. Well, the staff realizes with those words, you can't do that. So they sit down at Peter Strzok's computer on June 6th, and they expunge from Comey's statement the incriminating words, and they substitute something else careless. Where did they get that? Barack Obama. Because weeks earlier on Fox News Sunday, he told Chris Wallace, oh, Hillary Clinton, you know, she didn't intend to jeopardize national security, and, you know, she was just merely careless. So they adopted Obama's language to clear her. And, you know, that's the story of James Comey from the beginning.
I want to talk a second about the Hillary Clinton investigation, because was there anybody aside from her who wasn't granted immunity? I've never heard of an investigation where everybody is pretty much granted immunity, and then Cheryl Mills, her chief of staff, who was a witness granted immunity, interviewed by the FBI, was then allowed to serve as her lawyer and sit in on her, I can't call it deposition, it was sort of a casual weekend conversation around the 4th of July where nobody took notes or took sparse notes and they didn't record anything.
Right.
Was there anybody who wasn't granted immunity in that aside from her?
You know, there were five people who were top aides to Hillary Clinton. All five of them got immunity in exchange for nothing. The government didn't get anything in return. Instead, they not only gave immunity, but they gave extraordinary rights and access to some of them. You just pointed out Cheryl Mills. I mean, in my almost 40 years of being a lawyer, I've never heard of somebody who gets immunity who then gets to sit in on the target's interview. That violates so many rules and ethical regulations. It's mind-boggling because she can then tailor her testimony to Hillary Clinton's to help Hillary Clinton, which is, you know, the last person you put in a room with a target is somebody immunized. So it just shows you what a charade that was. Hillary Clinton in that interview, it was actually brief given all of the evidence. She apparently said, I don't recall, roughly 40 times. About the only thing she could remember was her name and date of birth. And that's it.
Well, the political world transformed and the scandal world transformed on June 15th or 16th, 2015, when Donald Trump rode down that escalator.
Right.
He wins November 8th, 2016 against all the odds. I didn't think it was possible, but it turned out he was right. How soon after do they go into panic mode and go and try and, what Peter Strzok labeled, an insurance policy? How soon after that? If Trump loses, we don't hear about any of this, do we?
Right. No.
No?
No. I mean, if Trump loses, all of the wrongdoing, misconduct, and what I think is illegality on the part of people like, you know, James Comey and Peter Strzok, Lisa Page, Andrew McCabe, the list goes on and on. All of that would have been dead and buried.
Mm.
And they were counting on that, by the way. They assumed
were
that
they
Hillary
brazen?
Would,
were they
oh,
absolutely brazen?
Completely brazen. I mean, look at the text messages between right. Peter Strzok and Lisa Page. That is a powerful narrative of severe and pervasive bias that drove them to abuse their positions of power to subvert the rule of law and undermine the democratic process. They were trying to undo the election results and destroy Trump.
How long after those election results does this really get rolling? Yeah, it started before that, but it wasn't a top priority. But after the election, who decides, what decides that this has to be priority number one? This is suddenly what was casual, ridiculous rumor mongering and the ability to spy on Carter Page and other campaign surrogates to this is important and we have
right.
to press forward on this.
Immediately. I mean, the Obama administration went into panic mode. Brennan, in particular, by virtue of his conduct, James Comey, realizing that his job was now, at the precipice, he would likely be fired. There is nothing that will motivate people more than power forfeited. And that's really what drove these people. They feared that Donald Trump was going to, as promised, drain the swamp. They were the swamp, didn't want to be drained. So they did whatever they could. They twisted the facts, they contorted the law to clear Clinton and then set up Donald Trump to frame him for things he didn't do. And immediately after the election, it went into overdrive.
There was a story in the New York Times, October 30th or 31st, that mentioned the FBI was looking into contacts between the Trump campaign and Russian officials, nebulous Russian officials.
Right.
But it wasn't a national obsession. It wasn't something that had really gotten a lot of attention of journalists until January.
Mm-hmm.
President-elect Trump in Trump Tower has a meeting with the national security apparatus. James Comey is there.
Right.
He sticks around. He has a private one-on-one meeting that later we'll find out when it happens in the White House he's wildly uncomfortable with. But while he's president-elect, he thinks it's very important that he has to tell him about the dossier. Then miraculously, shortly thereafter, the story gets leaked that the president, it's so serious, the president was briefed on this.
Right.
And that sort of starts the public phase of this, doesn't it?
It does. The Washington Post had written a couple of columns before the election about collusion, but it never gained any traction, mostly because I think the Post, like everybody else, figured that Donald Trump could never win.
Right.
That meeting between Comey and Trump in January before inauguration was a setup. It was done as an excuse to then leak the information, likely through James Clapper.
Because once you tell the president, once it's deemed important enough to tell
then
the president
it's newsworthy.
Then it's newsworthy because CNN, as we found out, was looking for a news hook to begin to report on the dossier.
Exactly.
And then the dossier gets published by BuzzFeed, it gets referenced by CNN, and then eventually everybody publishes it, and it sort of snowballs from there.
It does.
Was there a way In the Trump administration's handling of that, and it's a hectic time, I think they were caught off guard being elected.
And they thought it was silly.
They thought it was silly, but was there a way that they could have sort of let the air out of the tires early on in this? Is there mishandling in the PR aspect, do you think?
Yeah, maybe to some extent in the PR aspect of it. A full-throated statement none of this ever happened that's in the dossier. The real critical error, if you have to point to one, and Trump will tell you this, is his appointment of Jeff Sessions, who has to rank as the most feckless, useless attorney general in modern history.
Why did he recuse himself? He didn't have to. It was sort of a gray area.
He was duped. He was duped by Obama holdovers in the Department of Justice. You know, first of all, he fumbled his confirmation hearing and really stepped in a big pile of it. But that notwithstanding, when he recuses himself, he cites the wrong federal regulation. You don't have to recuse yourself in a counterintelligence probe, only in a criminal case. At that point, it was a counterintelligence probe. So, you know, he totally messed up in recusing himself. But his betrayal of the president is really quite stunning, and Trump knows it and is, you know, is understandably angry about it. Mm-hmm. When he swears in Jeff Sessions as the new attorney general in the Oval Office, the next morning, according to Sessions' testimony, he puts in motion the wheels to recuse himself. So think about it. He's standing there, and he's being sworn in, and he hasn't told the guy swearing him in that he's about to screw him over by recusing himself from what was shaping up to be an important case.
And Rod Rosenstein became Jeff Sessions' deputy on the recommendation of Jeff Sessions, right?
Yes, and you know, Sessions, I don't think, really knew Rosenstein and accepted the recommendation of somebody he trusted. And, you know, in Washington, you should never trust anybody. So, you know, those were two egregious errors. But look, you know, when you're sworn into office as the new president, I mean, you got to appoint 10,000 jobs.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's a huge, and it goes back to, I was recently reading a biography of Ron Chernow's great book on George Washington. And, you know, at the outset, he was just besieged by people who wanted jobs and so many jobs to fill in the brand new government called the United States of America. And so this has always been problematic. If you pick the wrong people for key positions, you can undermine your presidency.
Rod Rosenstein, though, you argue, should be the one who's recusing himself.
Oh, yes.
Why?
You can't be a prosecutor and a witness in the same case. It violates the Code of Professional Responsibility, and it violates two or three other rules and regulations at the Department of Justice and the Code of Federal Regulations. He is, since he authored the memo that recommended that Comey be fired, he's a witness in any potential obstruction charge. And yet he oversees the case. So, you know, in a way, I argue in the book, he's really, you know, not only prosecutor and witness, but he's kind of the judge and jury, too, because he gets to decide whether any action would be taken against Donald Trump.
As we've seen, it's kind of funny because the Mueller investigation, the media will tell you, and liberal activists, not that there's much of a difference, that there have been 26 indictments or 25 indictments, and that's serious charge. Russians charged, of course. They're never going to come face trial, but there is one company that was, of the three companies that were charged, that since a company isn't an individual, they had nobody to send. They hired a law firm.
Right.
This freaked out Mueller's team.
Oh, yeah, because he never thought he'd actually have to prosecute a case. It's easy to file an indictment, especially if you think you'll never have to present the evidence in court, which is what Mueller did. He didn't expect that it would actually be challenged, and he's struggling to make the case. But, you know, of the 20-some-odd charges filed, how many of them deal with collusion? Zero. Which only underscores that none of this had anything to do with the collusion authorization. All of these cases could have and should have been handled simply by the Department of Justice. And had Sessions not recused himself, there would have been no special counsel.
Couple last things. People always point to Michael Flynn, General Michael Flynn, short-time National Security Advisor, fired because he lied to the vice president, and he should have been fired for lying to the vice president. He has pled guilty to lying to federal investigators, and the left always points to that and says, aha, see, look, he's lying because he lied about contact with Russians. But as incoming national security advisor, should he not be having conversations with people all around the world?
Yes, and in fact, I explain that in the book, and I quote a law professor who's written a book on what you do in incoming administrations through the transition team, and Flynn was a part of that. Turns out Flynn didn't lie.
The FBI at the time didn't think he lied.
Right.
Just somehow later.
So they interview him under a phony claim of the, I think it was the Hatch Act.
Yeah, actually, talk about that for a second, because he wasn't necessarily aware of the fact that he was being interviewed, probed, really, by the FBI. It wasn't set down as, we want to interview you about something. It was more of a, can we talk to you?
I think it was the Logan Act, not the Hatch Act. At any rate, no, they go there under false pretenses.
Right.
They didn't explain the truth. So they interview Michael Flynn, two FBI agents, one of whom happens to be Peter Strzok, by the way.
he's the only Gump FBI, of this thing. He's everywhere.
The only FBI agent. He's the Zelig of... So they walk out of the interview with Michael Flynn, and they say, well, you know, he told the truth. We don't think he was lying. They tell that to Comey. They tell it to Sally Yates, who at this point now is acting attorney general until,
Trump fires her because she refused to defend the travel ban.
Right, she's an Obama holdover. So that should have been the end of the Michael Flynn investigation when the two percipient witnesses say he's telling the truth. That should end it all. But Mueller knew better. You know, Mueller, the lord of the law, Robert Mueller, decided to prosecute Flynn, even though he had no legal basis to do so. If Flynn had actually challenged this all the way, he would have won in a court of law, and it would have
been flat broke.
He would have been broken and dead. He already had to sell his house. And Mueller was reportedly threatening to prosecute Flynn's son. You know, so this is the power of a ruthless federal government, unlimited resources. They can destroy a person personally and financially. That's why Flynn threw in the towel.
What we hear, though, is that James Comey and Robert Mueller, these are Republicans. That sort of is the stamp from the media to
right.
say, this isn't a partisan bias. Of course, if you read George Will, he's supposedly a Republican, but you would never know it by what he's writing these days.
Right.
But talk a little bit about the absurdity of that claim.
Well, your party registration is utterly irrelevant and immaterial. It doesn't matter. What matters is your motive, your desire to use your position of office to undermine the rule of law. And that's what they did. You know, at the end of the book, I write, I'm not a Donald Trump apologist or sycophant, and he'll be the first one to tell you that there have been occasions in which he didn't like my reporting and told me so in no uncertain terms. So, and while this may seem to be a defense of Donald Trump, it's really a defense of the rule of law and how people in high positions of power abuse the trust of the American public by undermining the rule of law.
I've got to ask you about all the rage this week, the meeting at Trump Tower with, I can't pronounce her last name, but it doesn't matter, between Manafort, Bannon, Jarrett, and
Donald Trump Jr.
That they think they've got a smoking gun. This is it. This is where collusion happens.
Right.
It was a 5, 10-minute, 15-minute meeting.
If
you can plot to overthrow the results of a U.S. election in 15 minutes, we've got bigger problems than this. But this, again, is being overblown and because of the president's tweet.
Yes. The New York Times, I always read it every morning because I like to start my day with a good laugh. And so yesterday I opened the New York Times, and sure enough, a story about the Trump Tower meeting in the New York Times declares it illegal without citing a statute or anything in the criminal codes. They simply pronounce it illegal.
Would collusion be a crime?
No. Collusion is only a crime in antitrust law. Now, having said that, are there other statutes that might be applicable? Yes, in other cases, but not this case. I'll give you an example. George Stephanopoulos on Sunday said, oh, collusion is conspiracy to defraud the government.
I've noticed they've started to switch collusion to conspiracy.
Yes, because they finally figured out collusion's, you know, not really a crime. And, you know, it, I suppose one can argue semantics here. So Stephanopoulos cites conspiracy to defraud the government. Little George has probably never read the Supreme Court decisions explaining what you have to prove for conspiracy to defraud the government. It sounds ominous. Ooh, defrauding the government. No, it requires proof of deceit, craft, trickery, and dishonesty. How is sitting in Trump Tower in a meeting with a Russian lawyer who is supposed to be giving you information and, in fact, never does, how is that any of those four things that the Supreme Court says prosecutors must have in order to bring that case? Stephanopoulos doesn't know any better, and because he's never bothered to look up the law. You don't have to be a lawyer to understand the law. Others have, one professor said, oh, it's honest services fraud. Really? Did you read Skilling versus the United States? That requires a bribe or a kickback. But most everybody says, oh, it's a violation of the election laws.
It's an in-kind donation.
Yeah, nonsense. The Federal Campaign Election Act specifically states that foreign nationals may volunteer their services, including attending meetings and providing information. It is not a violation of the law. It's on the FEC website. Anybody can look it up. I'll tell you what. So it doesn't violate the election laws, even though CNN yesterday morning, it's a slam dunk violation of the law.
They're building the gallows.
They don't know
already.
Anything about the law. It always astonishes me how journalists make these legal pronouncements without ever bothering to look up the law.
Two last questions for you, Greg. In researching this and putting this book together, what surprised you the most in when you dug through what you found?
What surprised me is that on the day Comey is standing in front of cameras clearing Hillary Clinton, his FBI is meeting secretly in a building in London with Christopher Steele, the author of the phony anti-Trump dossier. So think about that for a minute. In the course of, let's say, an hour or 2 hours, it goes from a legitimate investigation of Hillary Clinton that should have resulted in a multi-count indictment to an investigation of her opponent over nothing, absolutely nothing. And that just shows you the power of the government and their willingness to abuse those their positions of power.
And what do you want people to take away from the Russia hoax?
That Donald Trump, in consideration of the law, the facts, and the evidence, is really a victim and not a villain in all of this. There are plenty of villains, and I identify them in the book, and the laws I think they may have violated and should be prosecuted under, but so far none of them are legitimately being investigated for any of those acts, and especially Hillary Clinton. The statute of limitations hasn't fully run on her conduct. There ought to be either a special counsel for her, better yet, a legitimate grand jury.
Why do you think Sessions is reluctant to do that?
Well, he's back in a room playing with his Legos or something.
I think Legos are all right.
Yeah. I have no idea what goes through that brain of his.
I think it's because he was in the Senate for so long, and it's all based on formalities and niceties, and so he just kind of he brought that mentality with him.
Sure.
You don't go after the person you've beaten. That would be unseemly.
You know, it's easy to be a United States senator in that comatose chamber that is about the least productive aspect of our government. It's hard to be the Attorney General of the United States, and Sessions is in way over his head.
Greg Jarrett, the book, The Russia Hoax, The Illicit Scheme to Clear Hillary Clinton and Frame Donald Trump. I'm going to ask you to sign all three of these.
Sure.
Go buy your copy on Amazon or any local bookstore, but you can enter to win two of them. One of them is mine. Tough. Can't have them all. And I'm going to ask you, Greg, to draw three names to win Dinesh D'Souza signed books from last week.
Okay.
You could draw and just read the name out loud.
I was going to require my glasses.
Yeah, that's fine.
It's all very challenging.
We'll fix it in post.
Sean O. Mills.
Sean O. Mills will receive the new book. We have two older books by Dinesh.
All right, I'm going to dip down to the bottom so that, you know,
everybody feels
Feels they're being treated fair. Paul Stewart.
Paul Stewart, congratulations. You get one of the older books signed by Dinesh D'Souza. One more, please.
One more.
I will.
All right, I'm going to go from the side corner pocket.
All right.
And a little pool here. Stephen Lippenholtz.
Stephen Lippenholtz, you're the last contestant on The Price is Right, because the price is nothing. Greg, I'll ask you to sign those for me, and thanks for coming in. Congratulations on the book.
You clearly read my book, and as an author, and you're an author too, so we both appreciate people who actually read books before an interview, and thank you for that courtesy.
I just lie very well. I appreciate you coming in. Best of success. It's already a number one New York Times bestseller, so there's nowhere to go but down. But don't let that get you down, because this book is going to make a difference. If you want to get educated on the Russia hoax, on the Russia investigation, Lord knows it's not going away anytime soon, pick up a copy of this book. Check it out. Read it. Learn it. Spread the word. Thanks for coming in.
Derek, thanks so much.
Click subscribe or whatever they put up here on the YouTube page. And follow me on Twitter @Derek A. Hunter and all that good stuff. And we'll be back here on Monday. Have a great weekend.